This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Okay, are we on? Are we online? Yes, we are. Okay. Well, welcome to the next session, which I am both convener and timekeeper. So I'll have to give myself a good talking to if I go over time. In this case, we're looking at the Shattered Anzac. And we have Dr. Elizabeth Roberts-Pedersen and Katie Mutton, artist. And we'll start off with Katie, if that's okay, if you'd like to just maybe give an introduction and then go into...
So, my name's Katie Mutton. I'm a visual artist based here in Canberra. And my artwork, or my interests, are really related to war and how it impacts on national cultural identity. Today I'm going to speak about a project, post-war project, which I started last year. And it grew out of an interest in World War I Australian soldier settlement, the scheme and its history. Really, it started... My husband, who grew up in a place called Calignan, which is just outside Mildura in Victoria, took me on a driving tour around Sunraysia region to show me all the spots, places that he'd grown up. And he had gone to high school in Redcliffs and was telling me about the history of Redcliffs in Victoria, which is about 20 minutes south of... I'll show you a picture. There we go. It's about 20 minutes drive south of Mildura. And it was one of the largest Australian soldier settlements to spring out of World War One, had over 700 block allocations. It was established in 1920. I think they started actually clearing late 1919. So I'm coming from a perspective as a visual artist who's just interested in history and was interested in the region. But my husband was telling me some stories about some of the old blokes and talking about blockies, which all the locals would affectionately sort of call the people who and families that grew up on those blocks, blockies. And I just kind of got really interested in it and a little bit internally outraged that I kind of had no idea about this history. And I thought it was actually such a huge... When I started looking at the numbers, such a huge number of men who... took up these blocks, this whole area of history that I really had no idea about. So I was struck by the scale, and I started asking or thinking about it in terms of how do, you know, over 700 men establish a community in this remote location, many of them having been gassed, dealing with disabilities and trauma. I just was really curious about the whole thing. So I started doing lots and lots of reading. First with Marilyn Lake's book, The Limits of Hope, which is about soldier settlement in Victoria. And luckily for me, a local historian, Ken Mackenzie Wright, had written a book called Land Fit for Heroes, which was charting the history of the blocks in Redcliffs. In terms of more almost genealogical, there's sort of an account of each of the blocks as much as he could track, and how the holdings were transferred. Anyway, so the things that I found out were that the majority of blocks allocated to returned soldier settlers had been located in remote regional areas, far from major cities. Many were too small to make a living from or unproductive, limited access to water, though not in the case of Redcliffs. Most families started without a house, lived in tents or sort of built small shacks. And although there were some training programs in place, many men had no farming experience and were probably ill-prepared to understand the challenges that would present once they were on a block. And more than half of Australian settlers had left their land by 1938, which is a massive amount. So I decided to start a small project to collate the research and became a bit obsessed by it, and I undertook an artist residency at the Art Vault in Mildura last year. And I invited locals to speak with me about the history. It was very, maybe brazen, I don't know, like not when you're from outside, even though I'm married to a local, it takes a while sometimes to warm up in the community. And so, but I asked around and said, look, if anyone wants to have a cup of coffee or something and just talk about the history, I wanted to learn as much as I could. So I put a call out at the opening of an exhibition I held, and a woman who I'd met before, Pam Shug, approached me at the opening and said, look, I've got this suitcase and I think you'd be really interested. Why don't you come around for dinner tomorrow night and we can have a chat about it? And I said, fantastic. But I was swept up in the opening, didn't really fathom what would be there. And then the next night I went round and this is what was on the table. So actually you can see bits of bread and coffee and things, but it was quite phenomenal. She brought this suitcase out. It was just an object of beauty in itself. And it's packed, obviously, full of letters and cards. There's ephemera, a hammock tag, diary, postcards, photographs. There are brochures about pruning. There are chemical lists, all sorts of things. And this, if you can just see at the top, there's this beautiful envelope with a little bit of bracken, the fern. That letter is actually a letter he sent. Sorry, I should explain who I'm talking about. The bloke up the top is Oz. His name's Oz Edwards, or Ozzy. And the lady down the bottom is Myrtle. And Myrtle, so Oz and Myrtle were sweethearts, and they are Pam's grandparents. Sorry if that I missed that little bit. So she presents this suitcase. It's full of letters, and it's all letters written by Oz to Myrtle, just about everyone. And they met in 1912 and basically track from their courtship. So he meets her at a hayride in Ballarat when she's 16 and he's 18. And they send correspondence. He signs up to... I'll just switch that one. Signs up to the war, goes overseas... goes to Egypt, Gallipoli, Western Front, is captured, becomes a prisoner of war in Germany, and then is back home in 1919. So he survives the war. So I took just a very small amount of images to show you today. There are just tons. It's sometimes overwhelming. So the story of the suitcase, Pam's grandmother... decades before, had given her a bunch of things that she wanted to have her incinerate. And Pam said she looked through, she sort of couldn't help herself, looked through the things and saw that there were letters, and there was no way she didn't really want to get into the letters and go through personal things, but there was no way she could burn it. So she said what she did was she put it in a cupboard and hid it away and thought, just keep it there and sit on it. So a few decades went by. Grandmother Myrtle was almost at the end. She said to Pam, look, I really wish I hadn't given you that suitcase to burn all those years ago. And happily Pam was able to say, look, it's okay. I actually stashed it away. But Pam's quite, you know, it's very... she loves her grandparents, a very loving family, and she still couldn't bring herself really to read the letters. And so this has been a really interesting journey for both of us, because she heard that I was interested and sort of knew me a little bit, because we had spent 18 months living up there briefly, but totally knew each other for different reasons. And so it's been a bit of hand-holding, probably for both of us, in terms of, you know, my tentatively wanting to look at it and be inspired by it, and her really wanting to share it, but also experience the letters and experience the correspondence for a lot of it, really almost all of it, for the first time, and get to know this connection that she has. So the really fantastic thing, coming back to Soldier Settlement, the reason that, because at first she brought them out, and everybody that I'd met that when I said I wanted to talk about soldier settlement, they're really keen to talk about it, but they tended to focus a lot still back on what the relatives did in the war. And I kept having to pull back and say, well, you know, actually I want to focus on what happened afterwards on the blocks. And so the great thing about this is that the letters start in 1912 and they go all the way through really heavily until the end of 1923, because Myrtle stayed in Melbourne working just in administration while Oz went up to Redcliffe's and set up the block. So you have this fantastic correspondence where he is writing to Myrtle every Sunday, telling her about the progress, writing from the tent, talking about the flies, the dust. You can see on the bottom right that letter, it's got a big smudge of red earth on it, and often he'll say, apologise in the correspondence, to say, you know, he's apologise because it's sweat marked or he's perspiring. And I've lived up there. I lived there for 18 months and in Mildura in the height of summer, and it's shocking to think of someone living in a tent and trying to write a letter and establish a block. Pretty incredible. I'm probably just... So, yeah, what I wanted to say also was... Oz did quite well on the block compared to a lot of people, and Redcliffe's itself is a more successful story in terms of soldier settlement. But one of the things that Oz's story enabled me to do is to... I did lots and lots of research and continued the research, and I wanted to creatively respond to the Australian Soldier Settlement Scheme and what happened to men when they came home. And so what this gave me was a more personal connection. Even though he had a fairly positive outcome, it meant that I could get a good sense of who the other people on the blocks were, who he was helping, what the progress of the land was like, talking about the heat, the flies, the hard work. And, it just sort of balanced my broader research. So I decided to use Redcliffe's, the location, as the catalyst for this creative exploration, and began to make a body of work. So earlier this year, I exhibited at Anchor Gallery in Canberra, and I put together a show which was made up really of explorations and ideas responding to the research. This is very large ink drawing on a very fine Kozo paper. So some of the things that I looked at were ways to represent the earth, the shifting of the earth, and I also started exploring the idea of microbes and disease and people coming back with illnesses and then that these might be transferred to families. I liked the idea of integrating text as well and bringing in the words of settlers, so not creating new text, just extracting from letters and research. So these are the first iteration of creative responses, I suppose. The second exhibition, there's a sort of a bookmark exhibition because I'm running a project website, so I share parts of the research and images and Oz's story and then more general information about soldier settlement on the website. I run Twitter feed and Facebook. So the book end to this will be April next year when I'll have a show in Mildura at the ADFA building, which is the Australian Dried Fruits Association building, which is a beautiful 1920s deco building, original, so I'll show that. But the very last bit that I just wanted to talk about quickly is where the work is going. So I made different types of work. We made some installation works where my husband baked 708 hardtack biscuits that we put into sweat boxes because it was all dried fruit in that area as an installation. And I invited, to represent one for each block, invited a performance poet, C.J. Bowerbird. the 2013 Slam Poetry Champion, to respond to the artwork and to the research. And he's written some amazing poetry and performed at the exhibition opening. So the different experiments will all kind of come together, I think, in this Mildura show. So you can see my research process. I've got some pretty crazy databases and spreadsheets on my laptop. It's become very... it's an everyday thing. And these are images of the way that I started to look at mapping the history, and what I was interested in is researching the blocks, researching how long people stayed on the block from the original settlement, what were the reasons that they left, and trying to create visualisations out of that data to help me understand, because it seems like a lot when you read about it, but actually to try and picture it in my mind, what that actually looks like. So this is me kind of preparing and highlighting and sectioning, drawing up the layers, then identifying all the blocks and then starting to piece them together. This is a in-progress internal image from Redcliffe's. And then this is another iteration. So this is the last one, but this basically represents a section of Redcliffe, so it's not all of the blocks, but most of them. And it's 1939, so if you can imagine, you're looking at the map, it's 1939, and what I've done is tracked from the original settlers who is now there. So all the gold are the ones that have sold their blocks or handed them back. It's a little bit hard to see on this image, but there is a kind of a ready orangey colour, which is all the ones that were cancelled. And then there's that might be a little bit easier. Yeah, it's hard to tell between the tones. But anyway, the kind of the massive gold and goldy colours are sold, or they've had their lease cancelled. And then all the little green ones are the ones that have died. And a lot of those, some of them are suicides. There are lots more anecdotal stories from children of settlers who I've spoken to talking about local suicides. But I haven't tried to identify them as such in these maps, but this is kind of where the project is at. So thank you.
Now, if we can go straight across to Elizabeth. Over to you.
Wondering, could we put up another of your... Is it possible to go back to one of Katie's images? Maybe the images of the map with the anecdotal suicides, because as grisly as it is to talk about, I mean, I think it's a really good entree into thinking about... I'm going to talk about military psychiatry, and we know that the soldier settlement experiment, that policy, is an ambivalent one. For some men, it's something positive for them and they succeed, but for a lot of men, they don't. And there is this hint that there are psychiatric reasons for that, or it exacerbates existing problems from the war. And this precisely this anecdotal evidence, family stories about suicide that are attributed to wartime service, difficult to prove sometime, but they often... I imagine you had a lot of stories. Yeah. When people find out that I'm working on military psychiatry, they will often tell me family stories about uncles or fathers or grandfathers who acted in certain ways or did certain things that the family understood in a context of wartime service. I don't know how much longer we've got, but I thought I could just give you an overview, I suppose, of my research or my interests, and I've got three main points I wanted to raise about the way that military psychiatry relates to the home front, but to this idea of the shattered Anzac, which this session is about. I'll try not to take up too much time. But as I said, I work on the history of military psychiatry and the history of psychiatry more broadly. And so my interest or view on the shattered Anzac is through that lens. Because, of course, Australian soldiers weren't immune from wartime psychiatric disorders, though it seems at times, and certainly probably in previous decades, before PTSD was recognised as a legitimate psychiatric condition, that it didn't always fit in with a popular view or even an official view of the resilient Anzac soldier. It sits at odds in some way with that mythology. I think the other point I'd like to make is that histories of psychiatry and histories of medicine more broadly can be marginalised both amongst historians, but I guess in popular consciousness more broadly. But I really think they resonate when we're thinking about wartime and trying to understand the effects of wartime, and particularly the wars of the 20th century, which is, as Bart said in the previous session, these are total wars. They're not just fought by professional soldiers, but they're fought by civilians in uniform, civilians who have been conscripted or volunteer. They come into uniform for the duration of the war. If they're not killed, they go back into civilian society. And so any medical aftermath to that or psychiatric aftermath often filters out into societies, but certainly into families as well. So three main points I'd like to make. I think the first one is that we can't understand current ideas and cultures around post-traumatic stress disorder, which of course comes out of the Vietnam War and a condition that was described at least initially as post-Vietnam syndrome and becomes post-traumatic stress disorder in 1980. We can't understand the history of that disorder or the idea of trauma more generally without understanding shell shock as it was framed in the First World War and then its iterations in the Second World War, war neurosis, battle fatigue. It was known by various terms. And we need to see those. We need to see that history, I suppose, leading up to post-traumatic stress disorder. It's not a biological entity. It's not a disease entity. It's a cultural construct in many ways. And there is a lineage between the recognition of shell shock in the First World War up to the recognition of post-traumatic stress disorder in the present day. We can also trace, I suppose, a change there from shell shock in the First World War. It was understood partly to be about predisposing weaknesses in the soldiers themselves. There was less of an emphasis on the trauma of the event itself that they may have passed through, though there was certainly some sympathy for that. Up to post-traumatic stress disorder in the present day, where it's understood that war is objectively traumatic, and so there is no opprobrium that attaches to patients that are diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. At least in the medical literature, we know culturally that there's some ambivalence there. So that's the first point. The second point I'd like to make is that the recognition of wartime psychiatric conditions, the steps that the psychiatric profession, the medical profession take to address that, the awareness that it raises in the community, I think goes a long way to explaining why psychiatry enjoys the current prevalence that it does. If we think about the forms that psychiatry took in the 19th century, it was an asylum-based practice. I think the mass wars of the 20th century changed that because psychiatrists come into contact with civilians in uniform. They treat more ostensibly normal people who have broken down under wartime conditions. And that really changes psychiatry's remit and the idea of who a patient is. It's not necessarily the madman in an asylum, but it's an ordinary person who is broken down under particular kinds of stresses. So it changes the way that psychiatry operates and the acceptance of psychiatry more broadly. And third, I think, and most importantly for this symposium, for the work that you're doing, Katie, for the exhibition out there, and I guess our discussion or our understanding about World War One in particular in Australia, is that thinking about psychiatric conditions in wartime, the way they were treated or not treated, how they were diagnosed or not diagnosed, can open a window onto private lives because, as the historian Marina Larson has suggested in her book Shattered Anzacs, which is the namesake for this session, many military psychiatric casualties, as well as other forms of medical disablement, those soldiers were treated in the home. They weren't necessarily hospitalised long-term. They weren't even necessarily diagnosed in the case of psychiatric conditions. So a lot of these after-effects of wartime were played out in the family home. And that means it cracks open a window, though it's difficult to get at because often it does rely on these fortuitous discoveries of letters. Hospital records are hard to get at because of various privacy provisions and privacy legislation that exists. But it's a way of cracking a window and thinking, okay, what is the aftermath of war in terms of private lives, in terms of family lives, the effects of caring long-term for someone with a physical injury or a mental condition that has arisen during wartime? What is the impact on spouses, on parents? And often it's parents that are looking after their sons that come back from the war, because we know that most enlistees were young men, young single men. So it's a way of opening a window onto private lives and trying to think about the effect that the war brings into the home. It's very, very difficult to quantify. It often relies on a kind of anecdotal evidence, but it is one way of trying to think about that particular aftermath of war, particularly important for the First World War in Australia, I think, where we have tended to focus on the military campaigns.
What I find particularly interesting with Redcliffe's is that we actually do, you can actually make a lot of connections through a number of, you know, there are still children of settlers. There have been some fairly good oral histories and the letters in crazy spreadsheet. You know, you can actually start to make these really interesting connections and like you said, try to get an eye. A better picture. I, you know, we had just in some of the encounters, people actually, I find, really want to talk about this history. I don't think that perhaps it's something that people haven't wanted to talk about for a long time, but certainly many of the people that I've spoken to in that region really keen to share their stories. A particular fellow in his 90s who I met through the Military Museum in Redcliffe's wanted to talk about the suicides. I didn't bring it up, but he just sort of offered up to talk about the things that he'd experienced when he was a kid. And if you looked at the official, or I have looked at the sort of official documentation, you don't see that. But through his voice, he would say, well, there were this bloke and this bloke and this bloke on this block that drowned themselves in underground tanks, or I was there when I was 10 and the bloke next door shot himself and my grandfather came and dealt with it, you know. So it is quite interesting, the layers that exist. And I think for the men on these blocks, places like Redcliffe's and the soldier settlements, I just find really fascinating because I suppose in the cities there's some men were diluted with people who hadn't been to the war, whereas everyone in that community had been, and the bloke I was talking to said, if I was okay, my memories of childhood are really great, even though I knew about these things were happening, I didn't feel traumatized by them. But he also said, I was lucky because my dad was a happy drunk. You know, everybody drank, absolutely everyone, just about, except Oz. They did. There were some that didn't, but a lot of people self-medicated, I suppose, through alcohol. And he said, but I had friends whose fathers, talked about domestic violence and that sort of thing because they weren't happy drunks.
Yeah, and there is some work, I think it's Elizabeth Nelson is a historian that's just published a book arguing that there may be a sort of an undercurrent of post-war domestic violence that you could attribute to the stresses of return and alcoholism, which again is sort of some people would say it's the dark side of that sort of larrikin, boozing it up in Egypt, but that heavy drinking culture in the military can persist post-war, and it's problematic for a lot of families.
I have just a question for you, Elizabeth. Of course, people came back from the war from day one of the war. So, in 14, 15, 16, it's not as if everybody came home at the end of 1918. Mm-hmm. Now, with the idea of the trauma, were there any changes during those war years in how the authorities recognised that this trauma was real, that this person wasn't a coward, wasn't deserving of a white feather? What changed? Were there any changes noticeable?
There were, I suppose this is partly, it's a broader story than just Australia, because there's a mirroring, I suppose, of British policy, where initially symptoms that were characterised as shell shock were understood either as malingering, so people faking the symptoms, or it was a kind of concussion, so they were neurological symptoms. As the war went on, I'd say after probably mid-1915, there is a recognition that these are psychological in origin, even if they seem to be physical manifestations of some kind of brain damage in some very spectacular cases. And there is enough sympathy and recognition, I think, in the community, but also amongst military and medical authorities to say, look, we need to deal with these men in a sympathetic way, even if there is a lingering suggestion that they're, you know, this might be a manifestation of cowardice or malingering in some way. You see it in things like, for very bad cases, people who are hospitalised, there is an attempt to segregate asylum. So either setting up separate military mental hospitals or actually segregating a military hospital into a civilian section and a military section, as though there is a kind of moral distinction between civilians and military patients. And there's various local fundraising efforts to help men with war nerves. It's sometimes described in the community. So I think there is a degree of sympathy. But of course, there also starts this thing, which is something up to the present day, this running battle between men who perceive their incapacity to work or their nervous symptoms as a symptom of the war and as being entitled to a pension, and then the department engaging in a kind of running battle trying to work out, okay, well, how bad are the symptoms? Can we document the symptoms? And how much of a pension are you entitled to? And that creates a lot of animus, I think, and it's repeated in the Second World War. It's certainly repeated in the Vietnam War. It's repeated up to the present day. So, yes, psychiatric symptoms, they're a medical problem, but they're also an administrative problem, a public policy problem in some ways for a government that's trying to administer a pensions regime and saying, OK, who is deserving of a pension and who is not? Easy enough if someone's lost a limb to quantify, very difficult if it's a kind of invisible damage. Does that answer the question?
I mean, I find it hard not to. I've just been sitting here all as throughout the day, information adds up, and I start to jump and wiggle in my seat. If you go into the exhibition, you'll find that as you enter the door, there's a story about Alice Yoxon. Alice Yoxon was born in Germantown, which had to change its name to Holbrook because it was no longer polite to call it Germantown. She joined the VAD, the Volunteer Aid Detachment. She had two brothers who served. During the war, she also had a boyfriend who was killed. And for the rest of her life, she kept a photograph of him and his obituary in what we call the workroom. It's sort of a place where she did all the work. She also knitted from the First World War till the day she died. One of her brothers got a soldier settlement block up on the Murray River, injured his hand, his hand became infected, they cut it off, his arm became infected, they cut it off, his shoulder became infected, he died. So he's sort of a legacy of the war that won't enter the history books because it's not war-related so much as, you know, anyway. I mean, she went up there with him to support him during those periods. Mm-hmm. Eventually, when she died, her daughters got in and basically destroyed all the historical records. You're talking about the documents, papers from the war that may have survived. And they went in and, in cleaning up the house, they just threw it all out and literally incinerated it, except for the stuff I could save because she was my grandmother. So that's what, a little bit of pride here, personal ego trip. But, you know, I think it's a reminder that it's not far away. The fact that she kept a picture of her first boyfriend after having, you know, boyfriends and marriages later and such, married for 40 years, shows the legacy, the continuing, partially trauma, but it just doesn't leave the memory. It stays there with people, even people who were not directly involved.
One of my students the other day, we did a week on shell shock in one of the first year history courses, and one of them said, could people on the home front get shell shock? And at the time, I sort of thought, you know, not that it was a silly question, but it was sort of a basic question about diagnosis. But sitting here today, I wonder if it was not a very astute question, you know, in cases like that.
Yep. Okay, I should open, rather than talk about me, we'll open the door up, the floor up to questions now before we go for afternoon tea.
Elizabeth, I wonder if what we now recognise as PTSD, and you said way back in the First World War was recognised medically. I wonder if, as a society, even though we've recognised it medically, we're not prepared to recognise it broadly because it destroys that myth of Anzac.
I think it's a it's an interesting question, and I puzzle over this sometimes because people, I mean, I guess there have been debates in the last 2 or 3 years about, yes, we recognise PTSD. It's been in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual since 1980. There are programs in place in the military, and yet there still seems to be this gap between people seeking help, and then if people seek help, sometimes they feel that they're ostracised, or that's some kind of, they're judged for doing so. And I think it is, look, I think there is something in that. Could we trace it back to a kind of mythology about wanting to understand something about a mythic kind of Australian resilience? Certainly, I've heard men in the military at the moment saying, look, that's a kind of ethos often amongst the men that they feel like is destructive to people seeking help. I sometimes wonder, you know, I'm not a clinician or anything, but I wonder if it makes people uncomfortable. It's an uncomfortable cost of war, which we recognise in an official context. But then how to treat it and care for people in those circumstances is a very, very difficult question. And I mean, as a historian, I sort of think it's interesting that we've known about this problem. I mean, we've known about this problem for ages, but officially there's been recognition of this problem since early 1915, and yet solving it has proved very difficult. Mm. That's not really an answer. It's a reflection. It's not really an answer.
Yeah, just follow up on that point. I'm not sure if you're probably aware, but I think within the last year there was a case in the States where a woman started sort of a campaign to stop calling returned servicemen heroes. And she had a brother who had returned from Iraq or Afghanistan. And she felt he was certainly damaged psychologically, but she said this term hero was stopping them seek treatment and help because they thought they had to live up to this image, and she was castigated, I think, in the media by various people. So just to add on to the discussion.
Really interesting, and I think families can have such a sort of a moral authority sometimes in these discussions.
I had a question. So you were talking a lot about the psychological effects of war and how people weren't quite sure how to talk about it or deal with it when it came back to Australia. Are there any similarities that you can draw between the attitudes towards psychological issues and the high instance of venereal disease that came back to Australia? Was it treated in a similar way? Or, I imagine people didn't know how to approach it or talk about it in society.
It's a really interesting question. And I mean, a crossover that I've not thought about, except that I suppose they both impel a kind of administrative response. It's interesting in some ways. I'm not an expert on venereal disease, but I'm not an expert about it in the first AIF, except to say I know the numbers were high, and I know there was this tension between, you know, do we punish the men and sort of construe it as a moral failing and discipline the men and dock their pay, or do we give them condoms and just try and prevent the infections in the first place? One parallel I suppose I can think of is I know in the Second World War the approach to venereal disease was more preventative, and that was certainly the way that Allied armies tried to approach psychological problems as well, which was saying we will vet out people that we think are prone to breakdown. They're not very useful things. In terms of thinking about it as a taboo, though, which I think maybe you were getting at, if venereal disease is a taboo, is mental illness a taboo? It's a really interesting angle that I hadn't thought of before, and I will think further on it, and maybe we can talk about it. Okay.
One more, maybe? Sorry. Oh, right. Yeah.
Bonnie again from Queanbeyan. It's only recently that I realised, when I looked at a 1911 photo of school children in Mount Gambier that included three of my aunts who became maiden aunts, that generation of young school leavers from 1911 were the generation that gave us the soldiers and was also the generation that confronted the Great Depression. And I think this comes together in the soldier settlers, where the soldier settlers were on unsustainable blocks mm-hmm. without adequate economic or agricultural infrastructure and supports. Mm-hmm. And the shattered men that came back from the war were then doubly shattered economically mm-hmm. with the Great Depression. And in our family, this was expressed in my grandfather, who used to truck fruit from Moss Vale up to the Sydney markets, and who saw his truckloads of fruit being dumped in the harbour because the price had fallen out of the market. And they then set up a growers' cooperative. And I think a cooperative was seen as a soft, non-socialistic, non-communistic kind of way of helping themselves to get a decent price. So the economic confrontation of the post-war impacts, I think, was hugely felt by the soldier settlers.
I think it's very layered. That the history of soldier settlement, and I know Melanie's been doing lots of work on New South Wales particularly, isn't it? It's I think it's incredibly complex because you're dealing with a scheme that took place in lots of different remote locations around Australia and different locations in Australia, you know, the weather and the earth quality and all that is different in different areas. So they, I think men on different settlements were dealing with different conditions, and some had better access to water, others didn't. Some had terrible situations with pests. There's that terrible story about that bloke down south. I think he was reporting like 3,000 rabbits a week or something he was having to kill, you know. There are some terrible stories from around the country, but they don't all sync together because the locations weren't the same. So I think there are fundamental kind of strains that are common, but each story is so different and each area was so unique. But then, they were hit with the depression, they were hit with those the prices of fruit. So I think it's a very complex history. And even just focusing in on one region, you quickly realise just how complex it is. And in terms of things like other impacts from the war, men with PTS, what we would call PTSD, often they were trying to work the land. A lot of them might not have been able to cope particularly well. Most of the men on Redcliffe's I know had been gassed. And had breathing problems. It's horribly dusty up there, the earth. They have amazing dust storms that come through that could inhibit you. A lot of the men had to go down to, say, well, Redcliffe's, for example, to Caulfield Hospital. They'd be away for 3 months, maybe 6 months, maybe 8 months, recovering or resting or having treatment for this war neurosis type thing. And who keeps the farm going at that time? It's the women and children working the land to try and keep the property so they don't get kicked off. It's a very, very complex history.
Well, thank you. We'll close it off there. We've got more afternoon tea waiting for us downstairs again. Thank you to our speakers. Thank you very much.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.